This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 261. Today, we're going to talk about Azure Stack with Microsoft Technical Fellow, Jeffrey Snover, recorded live 21st of June, 2018. A 99.9% SLA means you're protected from power outages, bad patches, natural disasters, and maybe even a dinosaur attack. Does it protect you from yourself, though? AvePoint Backup for SharePoint Online provides full fidelity backup and recovery, from individual items to entire sites. AvePoint can run backups up to 4 times a day to ensure your data is secure. Recover anytime you want without having to pick up the phone and schedule restore windows. Learn why AvePoint is the Microsoft Cloud expert at www.avpoint.com. AC, how's it going?
Man, it is fantastic right now. I am so productive this week.
Excellent. Oh, that makes one of us.
Well, I did something very strategic. This was planned for actually since last October, but it is amazing what you can get done when you drop your kids off at sleepaway camp for 2 weeks.
Oh, that's me next week. My wife and children are, the kids go on holiday, summer vacation next week. Today is their last day at school for summer vacation, and next week they're off camping. So it'll either be me on the couch without, you know, with only underwear on playing video games, or I'll actually be productive. And haven't decided which one of those ones it will be, but Scotch will be involved either way.
the kids have been gone since I got home on Sunday night. So I'm on the fourth day of a quiet house. And my wife isn't, I couldn't send my wife away to camp as well. There was an age limit on there.
But you got to figure out a plan for that.
That was last night. We set up our girls' night out was last night. So I still got caught up on a lot of stuff, but it's been, you know, you get to those moments where you're, or those times where you start to get productive and you're like, where's the next thing? It's like, I had a break and couldn't figure out what I was going to do. Last night, got 2 paintbrushes out, touched up 2 walls, came back, started working again. I was like, let's just get it done.
Yeah. You know, when you're in the zone, when you're coding and you put on some good tunes and then some headphones and you just, it's like you're an unstoppable force. It sounds like that, right?
Feels like it. Totally definitely feels like that. How about you, man? What's up with you?
Good. Yeah, I went to New York last week and hung out with the new company's New York crew. So they're headquartered in New York, LiveTiles. And so I went and visited their offices and got to meet a bunch of their team and everything. And it was a great trip. Very tiring, but really cool to sort of start meeting more of the folks and as part of the new company and getting to know people. So yeah, it was really good. Really good. And then this week, getting ready for a big production deployment on to AKS, Kubernetes, next Saturday. We're shifting everything from our current infrastructure to our new infrastructure. And so making sure all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed and the services GA'd and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. How does it, so I know you talked about this. You were looking into it quite a bit a couple months ago. And then, you know, we sat down with the guys from the AKS team at Build. There seemed to be, I got the impression from you that there was a little bit of stuff that was still a little not GA-ish and that they were still rough around the edges. Are they, are these all those things ironed out, or is it stuff that, you know, you guys can mitigate while the service is, I mean, it's GA, but it's still like a V1 kind of a thing. So they're still iterating, they're still improving, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you feel about it now? Clearly you're betting the farm on it. You're going to production with it next week.
When you say betting the farm, we're betting the farm with a backup plan. So we want to go AKS. We're on track to go AKS. We haven't hit any blocking issues yet. Most of the issues in GitHub are pretty obscure. So like there's particular scenarios that have issues, but for our needs, we're in good shape and it's looking pretty good. Our backup plan, we have a backup plan. If we do come across a blocking issue, then we have a backup cluster that's provisioned using ACS Engine that we're going to move to. And we've got a sort of a replicated production version of production running on that already. So yeah, if the proverbial hits the fan in a big way, we have a second option if we have to.
That's good. That's good. You have to report back and tell us how everything went, and you know, maybe be cool to do an entire, you know, show one time, or like, you know, how do you migrate from your existing containerized stuff over to Kubernetes, and also not just Kubernetes, but AKS as well, and your stuff like that. It'd be a really cool show.
What's super nice is we've managed to get it done in a way that really the infrastructure is not really a concern. So the way we deploy our application is the same, whether we use AKS or ACS Engine or a Kubernetes cluster in Google, for want of a better word, or, you know, God forbid, but given our guest on the show and all that. You
know. So,
I'll definitely get into it in more detail. But yeah, it's been really interesting and fascinating way to deploy apps. Kubernetes is just, I'm finding it really cool, really fascinating and very powerful, actually, really good.
That's cool, because I plan on rolling out a cluster to start hosting a handful of utilities I've got to kind of support my business as well. And I had that as a fast track project. And then I saw you guys were Autobahn track projects. I was like, all right, I'll just wait till CJ does it and then I'll learn from him.
Wait till CJ's banged his head against a brick wall a number of times and then learn from all my mistakes. I like it.
You have more devs than I have, so.
Hey, well, if I don't have any hair on Sunday next week, you'll know it's all gone poorly.
Oh, like this?
Even less. So, we'll see how it goes, but I'll fill you in and keep you posted.
Cool. Very cool.
Are you being asked repeatedly to integrate different business systems in ever narrower timeframes and with increasing process complexity? What if you could standardize the way you build these business processes so your team are focusing on higher value tasks versus the nuts and bolts of running the processes and integrations? Nintex can make it happen. With a Nintex platform, workflows from person to person, system to system, to the cloud and back. Got a custom system you want to connect with? No code extensions let you plug into systems simply and easily using REST and Swagger. With Nintex, work just flows, so your teams can work smarter, work faster, and be more connected than ever. Try it out free for 30 days at www.nintex.com/try-NWC.
So what are we doing today?
Well, we have a very interesting show ahead of us. We have a great guest that I will introduce in a moment, and we're going to talk about Azure Stack, which amongst other things, but we've spoken briefly on the show, mostly about some news and announcements that we've seen about Azure Stack over the last, year and a half or so, off and on. But we've never really dived into any of the details or gotten any of sort of the inside scoop, right? We've only ever talked about announcements and things like that. And so we have the opportunity to talk to somebody today who knows quite a bit about that. And so we definitely wanted to jump at the chance. So we have Jeffrey Snover on the show today. Jeffrey is a technical fellow and chief architect for Azure Storage and the Cloud Edge at Microsoft. So without further ado, welcome Jeffrey to the show.
Howdy, how you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. Well, like I said, just before we started recording, we really appreciate you coming on the show. We know you're a super busy man who has managed to seemingly only increased scope of what you're responsible at Microsoft in more recent times. And so we really do appreciate you being able to come on and talk to us and our listeners, who I think will find what you're currently working on fascinating, but also what you've worked on in the past. So why don't we just briefly pause there and have you introduce yourself and a little bit more about what you work on at Microsoft and a little bit of your history.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Jeffrey Snover, as you say, technical fellow. I joined the company in 99. And I've been largely focused in on sort of management technologies. Most people will know me for having invented PowerShell and the journey, the travails of getting that out the door. That was pretty tough, you know. And I actually ended up taking a demotion to work on PowerShell because they thought, oh, you know, why are you messing around with this stupid little shell? You know, who cares about that? It's all about the GUI. Don't you get it? It's about the GUI. It's like, no, don't you get it, my friend? When you're successful, we're going to have lots of data centers and lots of computers in those data centers, and going to each one of them with a GUI, even if it's a remote GUI, isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was ahead of the curve on that one. Unfortunately, I was about 5 years ahead of the curve on that one because I got demoted, and then 5 years to get my title back.
Hey, well, we really appreciate you taking one for the team on this one.
It turns out it's very expensive because they're like, why are you keep messing around with something that doesn't matter? Anyway.
Well, history has proven them wrong on that one. So we're obviously very, very valuable to the ecosystem now. Sure.
Indeed. I was on the right side of history on that one. So again, it took me about 5 years to get that back. And then I was again in charge of more scope, managed tools, et cetera, became distinguished engineer. And then at some point they asked me to become chief architect for Windows Server. Boy, you know, I like to joke, you know, that's the sort of title you put on the front of your grave, on the back of your tombstone. You say, also happen to be a father and husband. Yeah. You know, that stuff, whatever. But on the front,
Chief Architect of Windows Server. You know, that's a big deal.
Yeah. So does that mean Dave Cutler officially worked for you, or did
no,
you?
No, well, but it's funny you should say that. Microsoft has only had three chief architects for Windows Server, and they've been Dave Cutler, Bill Lang, and myself. Now, I have no idea how the heck I ended up on that list, but I'm on that list, and I'm going to own it.
That is definitely pretty well-regarded territory there, for sure.
Crazy, right? And yeah. So the other interesting thing about this is that each of us were consulting engineers at Digital. So we're all
right from DEC. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of the things your audience knows and loves, the kind of technical foundations, came out of DEC engineers.
Huh. Interesting.
Anyway, so then at some point got involved in Azure Stack. That's where I've been spending most of my time the last few years. And we recently had a reorganization. So now I've got the scope of Azure Storage and Cloud Edge. So that's Azure Stack and Databox and Databox Edge and Store Simple and Avere and all that stuff. And I have no idea what I'm doing. I am coming up to speed as quickly as possible, and they are doing some amazing things.
Well, obviously, those are all complex and nuanced things, and so they definitely need to get the chief architect of Windows on those. Probably, is Windows possibly the most complex piece of software ever written, Windows Server, in terms of lines of code?
If you look at the code, it would be. Oh, sorry. It's very large. In fact, we used to say that at some point, and Linux may rival it these days. I don't really know. But yeah, it's very large. And indeed, that's one of the challenges we've had with Windows is how do you get thousands of engineers to work together? Like at all levels, like culturally, communications, how does the code work? How do you do integration? How do you do builds? It's an incredibly hard problem. And here's where it really matters. Why in the world would you have like 5,000-10,000 people working on a piece of code? And the answer is because when you're done, a billion plus people are going to use it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Wait, a billion plus people? Well, here's the thing about that. When a billion plus people are going to use your code, guess what? Sort of got to work. And the difference between like right and wrong or right and almost right are so important, so vast that you spend a lot of time dotting I's, crossing T's. And that also then means you go slow. There are two sides of the same coin. There's no sense complaining. You know, when you're going to deliver your code and when you hit carriage return, it goes to a billion people. You pause before you hit carriage return. That's the deal. Like when you're sending it to your 100 of your buddies, you know, carriage return, have a drink, hit another carriage return, you know, whatever. But
yeah, it's an important piece of software for sure. I see.
When you see it's always fascinating to me because you see these really big and really important projects, and by important, I really mean like what you were just explaining, that the impact of something rolling out that doesn't go as well as you would hope for it to, or that it go the other way, that it's so successful that it's like exceeding expectations. So maybe the planning didn't account for the virality of something. It's always fascinating to see that. And the part though that I wish that we could see more of, from the outside, I'm not just saying this from Microsoft, but in general, this is a good use case, is the business of running one of those kind of projects. I mean, yeah, the code is complicated, but to me, the part that would be so fascinating is, you know, the things about how Microsoft had to collaborate on Git and to be able to create, you know, a new file system for Git because the code base is so big.
Yep.
The being able to, you know, how do you have teams that are so geographically and, as you said, culturally and language, I mean, they're so dispersed and feature dispersed, or diverse, how, and all that's going to come together as one story at the very end. I mean, it's all very modular, but still, I mean, to the layperson that picks up a Surface or has a new Windows update, they don't see thousands of modules getting updated. They see in 5 to 15 minutes, my machine's going to be updated. And it's just one big file that in my head, I'm thinking one big file to the end user. The business of seeing them, I mean, it would be so cool to be able to see like the behind the scenes of how that works. Of course, though, Those are the trade secrets, right? You don't want, you know, one company doesn't want to share with another one and all that. So,
well, you know, indeed, Microsoft is in the midst of a cultural revolution, and it's real, right? We got a new leader. It really is just a complete cultural revolution. And parts of that we're doing well, and parts we're still catching up. This whole, you know, embracing of open source software, being more transparent, et cetera, is step by step. So you're right. And one area where I think we've done a particularly bad job is sharing how we do things. And there's a lot of benefits. A lot of people will say, well, you know, how many people can benefit from learning how to run a 10,000 engineer project well? And the answer is, well, they might not, but there might be some lessons, and they might, they'll pick up something, and they might enjoy hearing the story. So, yeah, you know, Sam Guggenheimer did a very good job. I don't know if you've seen any of his talks, but he's done a couple, I think, at DevOps Enterprise and a number of places where he'll talk about the Visual Studio's journey to embrace DevOps, embrace CI/CD, how to transform their test culture, right? Mm-hmm. They used to have a test culture where, you know, you do a build, and then you take X, you know, days, weeks, whatever, to run through all the tests. And it's like, oh, and then something broke. Okay, well, let's start it again. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's not going to work. So we need to change it. So how do we ensure high quality with a small amount of representative tests? And that was a journey, and it took them a long time. And guess what? Recently, we said, hey, Sam, you know, why don't you come over here? Because we're dealing with some of the same issues. Why don't you come educate us on how you're doing that, or how you did that? So yeah, step by step, we're getting a little bit better on being transparent.
I think, I mean, Microsoft is definitely doing that. And I think that it's helping too by seeing how some enterprise companies that are sharing the behind the scenes of what they're doing and seeing the benefit, not only that, the benefit that other people are taking from it, but also the benefit that they're receiving back, because then people look at them as the leader. I mean, the two or three examples that always come to mind when I think about this is, you know, you're hearing all of the engineering stuff that Netflix keeps pushing out about their Simian Army and Chaos Monkey and all that stuff. And then on the flip side, you go over and you look at what GitHub does and the GitHub engineering blog or the Airbnb engineering blog. I can totally understand what you're saying when you said that, you know, people would say, well, we share what we're doing. How in the world is that going to benefit somebody else? Because, I mean, who else is building an operating system that's used by a billion people? And it's a very valid point. I turn around and see, like, you know, look at what the GitHub guys are doing, and I'm not hosting a source code, you know, repository multi-tenant environment, and all that has hugely popular. And if it went away, it'd be one of the, well, when it does go away for a couple hours here and there, hopefully when they move to Azure, it won't be a big of an issue. When it goes away for like 2 or 3 hours or something, and you see everyone goes to the status page and it's like, my job is really stopped right now, and you can't get anything done for half a day. But then they turn around and they share some of the stuff they do. Like, they did this whole like chatbot thing about how they do deployments and how their engineers are, can the more junior engineers can roll stuff out into production, and how they get into a queue and talk to their systems and everything. You saw that. And then I've talked to two or three other companies since they put that blog post out that showed how they roll code out into production and how their new devs can be inside the same chatbot channel and see how other senior devs are rolling their code out. And it's kind of like, there's no documentation. It's just you just need to spend time as an apprentice, kind of like you do like as a doctor in the ER or something. Watch how everybody else operates for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then you'll understand how we're doing stuff. But it's going to take you some time. And I've talked to companies that have actually rolled that same process out with just 5 to 10 engineers and saying, yeah, we got the idea from GitHub. It's like, well, they're clearly doing something totally different than what GitHub's doing, but people benefit from that stuff. And then, you know, you see them, people like us look back and say, or look at the industry and say, you know, look at what this company is doing. Look at what this company is doing. And here's the one, you're talking about containerized infrastructure, and you kind of look at what Netflix does and says, I buy into that. Now I can buy into it because I can see it works for a big enterprise, and they figured out a lot of the hard problems. So it's cool. It's really cool to see, like, you know, people being more open. Microsoft definitely being more open in the last few years. It's been nuts watching this. Somebody who's been a Microsoft guy since I came out of college, it's been nuts watching this transformation and trying to be able to explain it to people. You really have to live it to really grasp it.
Yeah. You know, I have three reactions to that. So first, you mentioned the Netflix guys and their Chaos Monkey. And let's just step and think about that. How many people have benefited from understanding that concept, right? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, it's huge. And what has that done to the quality of software and software services? And when you really step back and think about it, whoever made the decision to go open and discuss that has literally sort of made our entire world a better place. I mean, really, just the entire software industry is better because of that person's decision to share that learning. So, you know, hats off to that person. The other thing you mentioned was, yeah, things go wrong, right? GitHub was down for a couple hours. And the reality is, like, when you're just like, I'm using the software and then there's a problem, it's like, jerks. But when you, like, you're using a product and you're reading their engineering blogs and you're like, oh, yeah, that guy, you know, Sam Guggenheimer, great guy. And then there's a problem, you're like, well, Sam's not an idiot, so there must be some issue and I can't wait to find out what that was. And, you know, but there's this implicit trust because you've seen the person. And then third is it's a recruiting tool. You know, you listen to a guy like Sam and you're like, wow, I would love to work with that guy. That guy is incredibly smart. Like I would, my game, this is a real story. My game gets better whenever I deal with Sam. So guess what? I want to work with Sam a lot because it ups your game.
It really does. I mean, and it's, I think I love the points that you made there because I feel the exact same way. You know, when you see, everybody's going to have an outage. I mean, stuff happens. And when you see like an AWS or a Google or a GCP or a GCP or an Azure, when you see them have an outage for even a couple hours or something, or you see it come down to like an Azure AD kind of a thing, you're always kind of like looking back at the, waiting for the postmortem, like, what happened? Because I know you guys know what you're doing. This is a big deal. You have a full-time staff that deals with just uptime and availability and performance. When stuff hits the fan, what was it that, what hit the fan? Was it a lack of imagination, which everyone can suffer from? Or is it just a really weird thing, all the stars align? And it gets to be absolutely fascinating. Like seeing it was a couple of weeks ago, I remember seeing a tweet show up where for just a couple hours, there was, I believe it was either Netflix or AWS was subject to like a BGP routing attack that was, they had completely routed, all their traffic was going to somebody else that was essentially doing like Bitcoin mining. And it only lasted for about 20 minutes, but then it went back and it's like, and you watch this animation of all these routes change, and you're like, how the hell did that happen? It's really cool.
We all know it all. We all know root cause of all these things is one. It all comes down to one thing, and it's SSL certs expiring.
I thought you were going to say it's Carl, that guy.
That guy. Well, is he the guy that does the SSL certs? Because Carl needs a talking to. No. No, in all seriousness,
can I share a little inside baseball? Because you know, people might already have this in focus, but I know I talk to a number of people at conferences or other that don't have this in focus. And that is this. So, you know, you mentioned a GCP go down or an AWS go down. And a lot of people think that when something like that happens, you know, we hear it, Azure or Microsoft must be like, yay, look at them. And the answer is absolutely not. Absolutely not. There is no, nobody takes any joy out of our competitors when they go down or when they're having troubles. We all have just an incredible deep appreciation at how hard this job is. And when those folks are suffering, there's no joy. It's like, and there's more to it than that. So that's on sort of site reliability and stuff. So that's just an important thing to know. When it comes to security, it's a completely different story. It's not just, oh, I have empathy for them. The teams are actively working together to help one another. We have common enemies and we have common problems. And there's an incredible amount of sharing that goes on behind the scenes. And I don't know how open we are about it. I guess, you know, Rusinovich just recently hosted an event where we brought in Facebook and Google and AWS and the security people, and we're sharing techniques behind the scenes. We share signals. So there's a, you know, at one level, compete, 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 use my service, not theirs. But that's sort of at the surface. Beyond that, like engineer to engineer, and when it comes to security, company to company, there's an amazing amount of both goodwill and partnership that goes on. Mm-hmm. It's really, I love it, actually, because they're great engineers. I love working with great engineers. And guess what? Microsoft, I'd love to say we have a monopoly on all the great engineers in the world. We don't. There are great engineers at AWS. They largely came from Microsoft. No, anyway. They're a bunch of great people at every company. So it's great to work with them.
So Carl works for AWS.
Exactly. Okay. Hey, I think I have a great guy.
We might have lost our Carl contingent for the show. Yeah, but you're right, because I'm sure that there's, you know, everybody's company, their sales guys in the field, their field sales guys, they're all going to look at it as a competitive advantage. And they're all going to say, you know, look, this company went down and stuff. But I'm sure that when one of your competitors has an outage, or when Azure may have an outage and the GCP guys look at it, all the engineers are going to be like, what did they do? What happened, and what can we learn from this? How can we make sure that doesn't happen to us? Like when AWS melted down in Virginia, on my birthday last year, and the status page said everything's fine, but it was because the status page couldn't be updated because it was actually run out of the same data center. It's like, everything's not fine.
Wait,
caching is working great.
Was it a picture of that dog with the house on fire saying everything's fine?
That was the one that I kept posting on Twitter. I'm like going, yep, nope, everything's fine.
It was Baghdad Bob with tanks rolling past in the background going, the infidels are committing suicide at the gates. PR guy didn't realize what was actually going on. Anyway, we digress. Hey, so you work on a couple of big things in Azure right now. You mentioned a couple. Azure Stack is obviously a pretty big deal. Storage arguably is a bigger deal, I guess. I think.
It's huge.
And then sort of as a strategic imperative, the edge is obviously a big deal for Microsoft at the moment. And so those are all really big things. So how do you split up your time? How do you split your day? How do you deal with fingers in a thousand pies of all really important things? And I guess, yeah, where are you spending most of your time right now?
That's a great question. You know, if people ask me that, I never have a good answer. You know, you like to like sound smart. I don't have a smart sounding answer. So really, there's an incredible amount of interrupt driven stuff. Mm. And the challenge is that I find is, you know, one of the jobs is to be able to separate the important from the urgent. Mm. And so trying to find that, like, what really matters here? Like, what can I, and by the way, my background's physics, so my superpower is like throwing away complexity and seeing simplicity, right? Mm. Other people like love, like, give me more data, more data, more data. I don't really care about the data. What I want to understand is what's the narrative? Mm. What does this data tell me? Because then that tells me what I really need to look at and everything else that I can throw away. And so looking for those, you know, trying to find the space in the noise to look for the signal to then try and help create clarity for teams. Like, mm-hmm. hey, stop. That's not what matters. Mm-hmm. What matters is this. Stop. What matters is this.
Keep and the eyes on the prize.
Here's why we got to go do that. And they're like, oh, yeah, we got to go do that. And so, you know, that kind of generate clarity and then generate energy around moving the ball forward. Mm. So at the end of the day, as a technical fellow, we are amplifiers, right? Mm. And so that's what I try and do, is to look for opportunities that need amplification, look for areas that seem overly complex or where we're not making progress, and then go try and help make progress. So, you know, what does that mean for a daily basis? I read a lot of email. I talk to a lot of people. That's how I spend my days.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I guess that's really finding the signal and the noise. You know, one of the things they tell you when you join Microsoft, right, is like it's this massive fire hose, and the people that succeed don't sort of barrel face first into the fire hose and open their mouth, right? You sort of take little sips from it and hope you get better at picking the correct ones to dip into.
That's right. I used to work for Microsoft, right? So then you'll know this one, right? At Microsoft, here's the deal at Microsoft. By the way, I wrote a whole blog on this. If anyone is like trying to partner with Microsoft, you should search my blog, Jeffrey Snover, and the blog's like Working with Microsoft. Because often what they'll do is, you know, you try and start some engagement with Microsoft and you send some email and then you won't hear back. And they're like, oh, they're blowing me off. That's not what's happening. 99 out of 100 times, that is not what's happening. What's really going on is that at Microsoft, everyone has 10 jobs, and your only true job is to figure out which 9 you can screw up and not get fired. Absolutely true. So when something comes in, often it's like, hey, my hair's on fire. Does that look like a bucket of water? No, I'm not paying attention. You know?
Yes, yeah, prioritization by what's the biggest fire burning. Yep.
Exactly. So anyway, yeah. So I go into details about how to, if you want to partner with Microsoft, how to do that successfully or how to not do it unsuccessfully.
We've already got your link to your blog post, so we'll drop that in the show notes if anybody's interested in taking a read of working with Microsoft and kind of understanding some of the mental things they're dealing with and how the company works.
Hey, by the way, this is an idea of like signal to noise ratio and understand what's important. Is it okay if I share a drill into that on an Azure stack?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. Yeah. So, and so this is one of my big contributions. So we, Azure stack is the first successful attempt of taking Azure and shipping it on premises. We had lots of efforts before that, and they all had various flavors of like not working so well. And so as we're doing this, because guess what? It's freaking hard. It's hard, hard. And so just getting things working had consumed everybody's time and attention. And we were about to go do a, you know, next iteration of this. You know. But I stopped. I said, well, what are we really trying to do here? I mean, what really matters? What really matters? And the answer was, well, it's about Azure consistency. I said, okay, Azure consistency. Well, wait a second. Is Azure consistent? And then there's Azure consistent tomorrow and the next day and the next day. So it's really not about being Azure consistent. What really matters is staying Azure consistent. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. So what challenges are we going to have being staying Azure consistent? Because being Azure consistent, guess what? Really, 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 really hard. Staying Azure consistent, completely different problem. Completely different problem. And luckily, I was the guy on duty, right? Because I had spent many years as the chief architect of Windows Server. Now, as a chief architect of Windows Server, I would come out with some new operating system and I'd say, hey, customers, you should be using this. And they would say, I'd have conversations like, yeah, I'd love to, but. Oh, but? What do you mean, but? Well, but I got this third-party software, this application, and they're not available yet on the operating system, so I can't use your operating system. Well, that sucks. But I got this third-party software, and I would love to use it, and it's available on the new OS, except they want to charge me a full relicensing fee. So, you know, I'm not, it doesn't make economic sense for me to go to that new version of the software. So it's not going to work. Or, and this was incredibly common, say, I would love to. Man, such compelling value. It totally makes sense for us to use that latest version of the operating system. However, I got this third-party software, and they're out of business. I'm never going to go to that new version of the operating system. It's like, oh, my God. So what got in focus was, wait a second. When I allow third-party software on to my system, the third party controls when and if my customers ever update things. So I realized that that's never going to work, that cannot work. And I actually have to do the whole job. I got to solve a different problem. I have to not say, hey, it takes a village. Here's my part of the village, and then we'll have third parties and management tools and security agents and all that stuff, and together we will solve this problem. What I realized was, no, I have to solve the problem. I have to deliver an appliance which does everything, right? I have to eliminate the need for management agents. I have to eliminate the need for security products. And wherever there's third parties, by the way, I love third parties. There's great opportunities for third parties with Azure Stack, but they add it in a way that doesn't install software on our box. They consume the software on a box through protocols. And that way, I can always update my software without asking any third party, hey, is it okay? We're all cool. No. I'm ready. I go. I update my software. And then they consume my software through protocols. And I just guarantee those protocols are always going to be valid. So that was one of those things. And by the way, when I said this, people were like, no. What do you mean, no? It'll never work. Well, it has to. No, it'll never work. Jeffrey, you're out of your frickin' mind. Will never work. And in fact, I had a customer tell me that. I said, oh, well, you know, big bank. It's like, hey, I got to have my software agent on that box. I said, well, maybe you're not a good candidate for the use of this product. They're like, what? I said, by the way, it's not true. So what do you mean it's not true? I said, I can prove it to you. Do you want a SAN? I said, well, yeah, of course. I said, yeah, I know you have a SAN. Now, let me ask you a question. A SAN, what is a SAN? A SAN is a general purpose server with lots of disks, and it has a general purpose operating system that they tune for to deliver storage area network capabilities. Do you put your security agent on there? And they said, no, we can't. I said, right, same thing. So you agree a general purpose operating system can run on a general purpose server and you can run it in your environment without putting your security agent. That's the deal here.
Raygun provides full stack error, crash, and performance monitoring for tech teams. Whether you're a software engineer looking to diagnose and resolve issues with greater speed and accuracy, a product manager drowning in bug reports, or you're just concerned you're losing customers to poor quality online experiences, Raygun can provide you with the answers. Get full stack error and performance monitoring in one place. The next time you're struggling to replicate errors and performance issues in your codebase, think Raygun. Head over to raygun.com, get up and running within minutes, and dramatically improve the online experiences of your users.
Sounds like a real similar problem to cloud in general, right? With SaaS-delivered services and the way people are thinking about trying to apply that older mentality of, I need to control absolutely everything and I need to be able to put management agents on servers through, and trying to apply that mentality to a SaaS service that somebody else controls and runs and that you pay for those benefits, right? But with slightly less control. So I take it you don't let people put unsigned drivers in Azure Stack then?
No.
Fair enough.
By the way, and because we took this responsibility very seriously, you should check out, by the way, so part of that is we don't talk about the internals of Azure Stack, right? Why? Because you're no good. And what I say, I finally figured out a way to like express it in a single line, right? Often you try and say something, it's 10 pages, nobody gets it. And you say it's a page, nobody gets it. Then you figure out how to say it in a line, people get it. Azure Stack is for people who want to use a cloud, not for people who want to build one. There you go. Gotcha. Yeah, you want to build a cloud, get out your screwdriver, get out your unsigned drivers, best of luck. Here's a rabbit's foot, man. You're going to need it. Best of luck. So many people have failed on that. But you know what? By the way, at the end, did it actually help advance your business? Using a cloud advances your business. Building a cloud, honestly, it does not. It doesn't. Yeah. If you think it does, you're fooling. You're either working for Microsoft, Google, or AWS, or you're fooling yourself. Building a cloud does not advance your business.
It's funny you say.
By the way, I wanted to say. So go check out the one area where I do talk about the internals because I want people to know, and it's so incredible. Check out Jeffrey Snover, Ignite, Azure Stack Security. You'd just be shocked. It's so incredibly good. Now look, we try and be humble because I know the bad guys are going to find a hole somewhere, etc. But you take a look at that and all the best practices, like all the best practices, we're doing them all. I mean, we go to security conferences. Lee Holmes, awesome security architect. He goes to security conferences. He describes what we do and these InfoSec people are like, really? Really? Wow.
Sometimes having resources helps. Yeah.
Well, it's Will. Like we understood there was this moment of clarity, right? The alcoholics call it that moment of clarity. I have this moment of clarity. We are responsible. We can't say, well, we did our part. Best of luck. We have got to do it.
It's funny you say it like that too, because we run into, I live, and CJ's got a long history in it too. I've lived the SharePoint space for the last 15 years. And so we've come from a very much on-prem, got to have my own farm and everything. And then now, in the last few years, the cloud story has gotten to be really, really good. And so I love the conversations of sitting down with some companies. You know, I focus on a specific extensibility area that is much more advanced in the cloud. It's very behind the time. It's very dated because of the whole shipping software on-prem. So we're at a much farther version, much more features in the cloud. And I do sessions on it, and somebody will come up afterwards and go, well, what can I do on-prem? And I'm like, you can do like about 30% of what I talked about because all the other stuff's come out in the last 6 months. And they're like, yeah, but you know, I can't go on-prem. And I love having the conversation with them and trying to really understand, why is it that you don't go, why don't you go to the cloud? Why can't you go to the cloud? Why do you think you have to stay on-prem? And what's the benefit of staying on-prem? And there's always like legal and there's always like regulatory and geopolitical stuff that does put it in there. But seeing that whole discussion with them on like, why do you think you need to stay on-prem is the real story. And it, I mean, it's I don't know if this is in the plans or anything, but to me, it's like, you know, it'd be great if the Office team would say, we do have an on-prem story. You effectively are going to be installing SharePoint on top of Azure Stack, but we're doing it and we're managing it. And there's a whole like Office 365 on-prem. I no clue if that's what's going on, but it's like, that would be a good story because that's
a good story.
That gives them the ability of what they're looking to do, right? You want to stay, you have to stay on-prem because of, like I've worked with an oil company that was in Libya and they're like, oh, Libya's got laws that says your data can't leave Libyan yes. soil if it's coming from like exploration stuff in Libya. It's stuff, laws like that, that you just can't technically, you know, move around, but it's still.
No, those are real. Those, yeah. There are not as many as people think, but there are some real laws like that. And that's where Azure Stack comes in. That's one of the biggest scenarios for it. You know, we say it's disconnected and edge scenarios, places where data regulation applies and where you want to modernize a front end to a legacy system. Say you got an Oracle system or an IBM mainframe. You want to put a cloud front end on it. You want it right next to it.
Yeah, gotcha. I guess that leads on to a really interesting topic. What have you seen recently, examples of what customers are doing that you've stopped and thought, holy smoke, I never thought they were going to do that? Or not in a bad way, but in a great way. Like, what are some really interesting customer scenarios that you've seen with Azure Stack in the last wee while that you sort of stopped and thought, wow, that's really making a big difference to the way they do business?
Yeah, some of those I can't talk about. So let me tell you.
Sure.
let's figure out what I can talk about. So we see a lot of people doing stuff you'd expect, right? One of the great benefits of Azure Stack is it's Azure. But and so what you see is you have to see service providers who will take this and they'll say they'll offer Azure Stack to their customers. And then they offer it with some additional expertise or whatever, or in a location where Azure isn't to deal with some of those things. So we see a lot of that. We see, I know how I can talk about it. So right now, Azure Stack is, it starts off as small as 4 nodes, and it goes to 12 nodes, and shortly we'll have 16, and then we'll have multiple racks of 16, et cetera. And so, you know, we'll scale as quickly as possible and as large as possible. And here's the question. So I expected to have a lot of conversations around the flavor of, hey, when can I get to 800 servers? You know, that's sort of question. And I'll be able to say it this way. What in fact we're finding is a whole lot more people who want to be able to, who are asking the question, hey, how quickly can I get to 100 instances of 8 servers? It's like, wait, what? Like, oh yeah, no, they want this, but they want like lots of them, like, and then separate. Like, and then I won't give any more details, so but all of a sudden you can connect the distance.
Oh, breadth as opposed to depth.
Here's another way to think about it. And again, not announcing anything, but as part of my investigation, I'm working with the IoT guys and their fleet management stuff. Because what I'm saying is, you know what? A lot of people think of like IoT as like a Raspberry Pi. No, my friends, IoT is like, it's about fleet management and location and connectivity. So we're actually looking at the possibility of doing fleet management through the IoT management tools. So the same tools that you manage your Raspberry Pi, you might be using to manage large collections of Azure Stacks. I probably shouldn't say too much more. Don't take any of that as a promise.
But the concept is management in a breadth manner. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess that makes, I vividly remember dealing with customers that wanted to put small racks, admittedly, but racks of servers running Exchange and SharePoint and all that sort of stuff in remote locations. So, you know, they'd go in and open a mine or something and they wanted some connectivity in that location and it had to be local or there were ships, like shipping companies that when the ships are in port, they connect and they download a bunch of stuff. And then when they're out at sea, they have less connectivity and they need to be able to still get to their documents and all that sort of stuff. And so,
and they use an amazing amount of computing on a ship.
Yeah, sure.
I was shocked how much computing there is on a cruise line. Holy schmoly.
Yeah. No, it's a big deal. So I can certainly imagine people wanting to manage Azure Stacks wherever they happen to be, on ships or subs or like, you know, remote mining locations or whatever it happens to be. That makes perfect sense. And it sounds like it links very tightly to kind of your previous life in PowerShell and managing things remotely as well. So I'm sure you have a few lessons learned that can be applied there as well.
Absolutely.
Excellent. So I've got one question that it's really impossible to answer in a short period of time. But But hell, I'll throw it out there anyway. So where do you begin when you sit down at a table with a whiteboard and go, we're going to take Azure and stick it on a bunch of servers and let customers run this stuff? Like, where do you even begin from? Like, the technical piece of me explodes with complexity at that point, right? Something that was built, Azure was, I imagine, was never built for other people to run it. And so you've got to take pieces of that and get it all running on in somebody else's data center, so to speak, right? I mean, where does that even begin in terms of the technical hurdles and challenges of taking something that's never built for other people to run, to drop it in a, admittedly, more controlled environment than just anybody's random old server, right? Because Azure Stack is a combo of hardware and software, as I understand it.
Yes.
So it's more tightly controlled than somebody else's server, obviously, but still a huge, huge technical set of hurdles to jump through. So what are some of the things that you, that as a team went through to go, how the hell are we going to solve foo?
Great. So first, the heart of engineering is proceeding in the face of not enough facts.
Yeah,
full stop. You just gotta go.
Right.
And so if you like, and there are people who are vastly uncomfortable with like we can't start coding until we know everything. It's like, yeah, that's not gonna work.
You'll never get there. Yeah.
Exactly. And so then what I do is I kind of zig and zag between bottom up and top down. And I find that super effective. You know, top down. Okay, what's the big animal? I call it the big animal picture, right? I got a giraffe and I got a lion and the lion eats the giraffe. You know, what are the big animal picture of this thing? So, okay, I got software and it's in here and then I got disks and I got what? You know, big animal. And then bottom up. Okay, wait, how's this going to work? I got these pieces. And so kind of, and proceeding. And so, and then you make progress and then you iterate. And it's iteration. And you definitely make mistakes. And then at some point, you go to a certain point, well, great, I'll be open kimono here in that transparency. I'll talk about some of our challenges. So as we were doing this, the previous instance that wasn't as successful was something called Cloud Platform Solution. And Cloud Platform Solution used System Center to manage 1, 2, 3, or 4 racks of computers, right? And that was great, except people said, oh, you know, no, we need to have smaller proof of concept systems. We want to start in half rack systems or even smaller. And so we're like, okay, so as we're doing this, at some point, sort of middle of the project, executive made a decision, hey, we're going to not use System Center because it's too large, too general purpose, and isn't going to give us, allow us to start on 4 nodes. And that was the right call. Like, we had no plan. Okay, so we got to rewrite all that from scratch.
Gotcha. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
That's why we have over 250,000 lines of PowerShell. It's all custom built for the scenario. It works very well. But you go and you do something. And by the way, and so for some reason, this is a little kind of scab. We'll go ahead and pick at the scab. Somehow somebody set an expectation of when this stuff would be delivered. Now, I know the team never did, and I don't know that anybody ever did, but in somehow everybody sort of knew it was going to happen in this time frame. Anyway, then you would go and we say, yeah, this thing you're sort of counting on, pulling that out, got to start from scratch. It was a challenge, right? And so it turns out that initial, like, hey, we'd like to shoot around this time frame, we shipped about a year after that. And everybody thought, oh, that team's a bunch of screw ups. They're a year late. It's like, what? Really? I remember having a conversation with a reporter who was giving me that, like, oh, you're a year late. You know, what went wrong? And I was like, dude,
right.
Public cloud running in your data center. Which part of hard is confusing you? Well, anyway, that's the trick, right? You go up, you go down, and you just move forward. You have problems, you get a punch in the face, shake it off, keep going. And, you know, you definitely make mistakes along the way and try and undo them, but...
Yeah, no, definitely. It's an unfathomably complex problem. So, you know, we have watched over the last couple of years, I guess, different technical previews and things like that, and things took a little longer than everybody was expecting, absolutely. But if you've, like you say, if you've ever worked on a complex software problem, sometimes you got to change stuff around and make the right decision over shipping the wrong one, right? So,
yeah, but it's actually working out pretty well. You know, we've been updating it on a monthly basis. You know, there really is this. And again, you're always learning. So, you know, customer orders one of these things. There's a knock on the door. Their vendor shows up with this hardware. They wire it up. Now, then there's integration. Hey, how do I integrate with your Active Directory or your identity system? What addresses can I use, et cetera? And it turns out that if the customer hasn't like had those conversations with the networking people, then the vendors, they're like, I can't proceed until you get me this information. Oh, well, Carl's on vacation. Can you come back?
Damn it, Carl.
Yeah. Like, what? Come back. And so now we're like, okay, hey, let's make sure people are really clear. When you buy one of these things, make sure you have this information. But when they do, it's pretty no drama. They show up, they knock on the door, they come in, they have the worksheets that you've given them, they plug in those values, crank, and then you got a cloud. Like you got a cloud. Like a guy knocked on the door and like a day later, you got users doing IaaS and PaaS. Like it really works.
So they literally getting...
It really works.
So say I've asked Cal for some IP addresses and all those kinds of things, and I've got a couple of power sockets to plug in and all that sort of stuff. So I literally, this thing arrives as a black box. I plug it into the wall. I give it some juice and some network connectivity, make a couple of configuration things. And then am I literally looking at the Azure portal that I would see in actual Azure, but I'm running the thing on-prem?
Yes, exactly. Nice. So you just change your URL. And by the way, so you got a bunch of developers, you code against this thing. How do you code against it? And the answer is you change the URL.
Interesting.
Instead of going to public Azure, you have a local thing and you use the same URLs. Or so you use the same APIs.
So, you know, the developer in me goes, that's an awesome story, but like, I'm going to AKS. Is it real? Right?
Yeah.
And so I imagine at some point, down the line, Azure Stack will support AKS and all these other newer kind of Azure services and stuff. What does that process look like in terms of, like, what do you support today in Azure Stack? And then when customer goes, well, that's awesome, but I use insert obscure NVIDIA-based GPU here SKU.
Yep.
We talked to Corey Sanders at Build about all of the kind of stuff that goes into SKUing and, like, how you deal with bringing on new VMs and all that sort of stuff in Azure. What happens in those situations where, like, what do you support today? And then you must have a raft of stuff that you're looking at going, how do we support that in Azure Stack?
Great question. And this is important, right? Because it's true and it's not true, right? Hey, this really is Azure running in your data center. That's true. What's not true is that it's true as much as you can be true in a single sentence. The next paragraph says, but go find out what that really means. Because if you are counting on some random, you know, like the 1% feature, that might not be in here. So you got to be crisp about for the things in Azure Stack, they're the same as they are in Azure. So all your IaaS stuff, but again, not all of your IaaS features. We got a big work effort to get managed disks. That'll be coming up later in the year. But currently we don't have that. And so we're getting all of our stuff up to date. So we got IaaS, we have a number of PaaS services, we're getting Service Fabric, we've got Kubernetes and templates, but AKS will come later on. And so the best way to do this, and you definitely want to understand what the capabilities are and sort of where the roadmap is. And guess what? We're fully transparent. If you just search Azure Roadmap, we have an Azure Roadmap. And in there, there's a filter. And one of the filters is Microsoft Azure Stack.
Gotcha.
And you click on that, and it'll show you all the things that we have and all the things that are in preview and all the things that we're working on. And so you want to get that in focus. Like, because if you're counting on a content distribution network, I don't have one of those.
Gotcha.
Like, that's what you were hoping for. Don't buy Azure Stack. But a bunch of the things, I mean, they truly work.
You might already have this, but if you don't, you can take this idea and run with it. But you need like a little wizard that you stick your ARM template in and it comes back and goes, oh, you're good to go. Oh, you already have that? Nice.
Yep.
Okay. That's pretty cool. Yeah, that would be super useful, right? So,
Johnson tool.
Yeah.
Chris Johnsonize it.
Yeah. Hopefully somebody will use it. Yeah, I wouldn't call it that. But anyway, I will. we've got to be very cognizant of time, and sure, we know we're at time with you. So we could talk about this for days and days. But there is one really important thing we like to do with our guests at the end of a show, where we ask you what something interesting or something you found fascinating in the last wee while. And so 1 second and we'll get right back to that.
CJ's Hyperfish automates the collection of user profile information from users in organizational directories such as Office 365, SharePoint, Active Directory, and HR systems. The secure service supports on-premises, hybrid, and online environments. Bring your directory to life at hyperfish.com.
AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework.
Okay, Jeffrey, not to put you on the spot, but this is the most important part of the show. This is what our listeners wait for. Every week we come out with a show and the most feedback we get is about the picks. So I'm only kidding. Sometimes. So
depends on the guest.
Yeah, exactly. We've given you, it's actually very interesting to see what people come up with, actually. Some people are very serious and other people are not so serious. And it's a real personality test. Anyway, so we've given you some warning about picks and you have one for us, right? I think you brought one to the show.
Yeah, actually, it's in my backpack right now. But one of my favorite objects is the Fisher Space Pen. So I don't know if you've seen, it's got at some point... Lee Holmes. At some point, you should have Lee Holmes on the podcast because he's just an amazing guy, fantastic security guy, and sort of a renaissance man. You know, he does welding and he's into knitting and every week he's picking up something. He's got a laser printer, all this crazy stuff. Anyway, so at some point, he makes the offhand comment. We're having a coffee and he says, "Oh, if you ever want to go down a rabbit hole, search EDC on YouTube." Like EDC, everyday carry. So, want to go down a rattle? Go down that one. It's funny.
Sounds right up our alley.
Oh, man. So I got into this whole EDC. And one of the things was the Fisher Space Pen. It's just a pen that, it's the design. You can work in space. You can write upside down. You can write underwater. And this pen is just wonderful. I just love it. It's just a fantastic object. Fits in your
Small and compact.
And it's just, it feels good in your hand and it works. And anyway, it's just every now and again, you just get an object and you're like, I like this object.
Yeah, fair enough.
Sometimes good ballpoint pens are that way, the Mont Blancs, because they're heft. This isn't so much heft, it's just a beautiful object.
Nice. Well, I'm a proud owner of a space pen already. Oh. So I totally agree with your pick, I got to say. But a funny story about this is that NASA spent millions making this pressurized pen, right? So it'd write upside down or in zero gravity, and the Russians took a pencil.
Exactly. I see all this space stuff in the back. We took the kids to NASA for a vacation, and we did one of the behind the scene things to talk to some of the engineers, and they talked about how they had the Russians working together, and they just really appreciated their design simplicity, their straightforward approach to engineering. It's great.
Yeah, I'd love to go and tour Baikonur and some of the old facilities, their launch facilities and rockets and things like that in Russia.
Do you have time for a crazy story?
Always.
Of course.
Yes, we do. We do.
Okay, so I'm a technical fellow, and that means I'm part of the executive staff at Microsoft. And every year we have an executive retreat. We go off somewhere and here's what we're doing, all this great stuff. And it's 3 days worth of great stuff. And then at night, guess what? We go to the bar, we talk. And so you meet people and stuff. And so then I'm talking to this guy next to me, da-da-da-da-da-da.
I think I see where this is going. Maybe. I'll hold my breath.
And turns out he's been up in space.
Charles Simonier?
Charles, twice. And so he's telling me all these stories about going up in space and on the Soyuz capsule. And it's like, wait, like you went...
Actually space?
And the International Space Center for 2 weeks the first time. And he's telling all these crazy stories. And it's like, the guy, there, right next to me.
That is incredible. Is top of the bucket list is going to space. And I saw him go the first time, and I read about him going the second time, and he lives down here on Lake Washington, and so sometimes go past on the boat and go see his house and things. But as a private citizen going to space, that is, and not just space, like, because there's going to be going to space and then there's going to space, right? And really going to space is really going to orbit, right? And that's a whole different kettle of fish than going up and down. But yeah, he's been up there for a few weeks and just hanging out on ISS. That's crazy.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Amazing.
I love when you get the opportunity to sit there and talk to somebody like that and get like the stuff you don't normally read about, the stuff you don't normally hear. It's like I did one of those, it's a NASA social where they bring people in and they show you behind the scenes stuff. And
yeah.
I'll never forget when I did one and astronaut Doug Wheelock was up and he came and spoke to our group. And it was the day that SpaceX landed the first rocket on the drone ship. And so we were there for the launch and we're getting on the bus to go out to go see the rocket before they start fueling it. And he had nothing to do and he kind of goes to our tour guide and he's like, where are you guys going? We're like, we're going to go out to the Falcon 9. And he looks at the tour guide and he's like, I have nothing to do for like 3 hours. Can I go with you guys? And so for the whole bus ride out, we're just asking him questions. And he's like, oh, here's something they don't tell you about. And here's something they don't tell you about. And it's like, you come back and you're just like, I got to see a rocket, but I got to hear what it was really like on ISS and how it, you know, that's you crazy. Put a t-shirt on when you get home and your back and your shoulders are burning for a week or for days because yeah. your skin's not used to just the touch of cloth.
Right.
Oh, it was fascinating.
That is fascinating.
Oh, that's cool. He told us a lot of stuff. He said, don't tell anybody this. And I'm like, oh, I got to get back on my podcast. I got to go.
You know, your comment about simplicity and signal from noise reminds me of a quote from Chris Hadfield, who's the Canadian commander of ISS. Yeah. And he said, as an astronaut, you really quickly figure out that no matter how bad the situation is, mashing a whole lot of buttons can always make it worse.
Yeah, it was funny hearing about an emergency that happened, an ammonia thing goes, and everyone's like, are my ears popping? Are we on fire? And can I breathe? I can do all those things. Okay, now let's worry about the problem.
Well, that's a great pick. It's a pen pick. And
my accent. Pen pick. Anyway, I like that.
Yes, we'll drop that in the show notes for anybody that wants to go and get a Fisher Space pen. AC, have you got a pick for us, buddy?
I do. I had one that I was holding on for a little while. And then when I saw what Jeffrey was going to share with us, I had to go back and pull the one out that I was originally going to show today. And it's by an article that, CJ, you're going to love this. It's called, it's by Nautilus, and it's called Scavenging Russia's Rocket Graveyard is Dangerous and Profitable. Mm. And so we launch rockets out of Kennedy Space Center and they go generally out to the east and they land in the ocean. But when you launch them from the Baikonur Cosmodrome over in Kazakhstan, there's like a line that the Russian space agency kind of draws and says, we'll give you 24 hours to get out of the way of this because there may be like a really big piece of metal
that comes back to Earth. Sky.
But what's interesting about this article is that there are people and farmers and stuff that actually stage themselves along with binoculars and everything. And when pieces of the rockets come down, they rush out and scavenge and get like pieces of titanium, other metals, they get copper wires, all the stuff that has fallen back down. The Russians used to go get it all, but after when they just realized it was, they want to keep all their technology out of other people's hands. Now they don't care as much. The stuff just falls, stuff's rusting out. And they say like now when you go into this whole like farmland area, you've got complete barns that still have like parts of, I think it's called the proton rocket is what they used the Soyuz up. And you can even see still like the proton like logo is on the side of like these barns because that's the scrap metal that they use to go through and to build their barns up.
Wild. That's cool.
Incredibly toxic.
Some of it is. And well, I mean, it's never been like a safety was never a huge concern of certain countries, I would say.
Okay. Similar vein. My pick before we wrap up is an article called McMoon, How the Earliest Images of the Moon Was So Much Better Than We Realized. So this is basically the story of a set of folks that went and got the original tapes from the lunar orbiter 1 through 5, I think it was. There were 4 or 5 unmanned lunar orbiters that went to the moon and imaged the moon before astronauts went there for Apollo, and they imaged the moon. And anyway, so at the time, you know, NASA released images. They didn't want anybody else to know how good their data was, right? And so they released lower quality and grainier versions than the originals. But the original tapes, these magnetic tapes from equipment that was, you know, I forget the name of the machine now, but it's sort of archaic and old. All of the tapes were still there. And so these guys went this team got together, they found all of the tapes, pulled them all together. Somebody gave them temporary space in an old McDonald's. And this was on, I don't know if it was at Kennedy or no, it was somewhere else. Anyway, there was this unused old McDonald's on site. And so they got that, they found the equipment, they found, tried to find experts that knew what to do with the equipment. They refurbished all the equipment just so they could read these tapes. Nobody knew what the encoding scheme was. Even the numbers written on the tapes, they didn't even know what it was, the coordinates and all that. So they figured out all this stuff. Anyway, so now they've scanned all those tapes and they've released this super high resolution photography and imagery of the moon's surface. And it is super detailed. They show before and after photos and it's just breathtaking. So
wow.
It's incredible level of detail that people hadn't seen before. And they were kind of running the risk that, you know, if somebody didn't save these tapes, eventually they'd get forgotten about or deteriorate and disappear. But there's this whole story of how they, you know, in the kitchens of McDonald's figured out all this stuff and brought these tapes back alive.
That's the cool. Pictures are awesome. I read this article earlier this week, and you can see like in the background where you have like the little stools all over the place, and you have big spools of tapes just like all over the place in the background. If you look closely, it's like this McDonald's was completely taken over by old tapes.
Yeah, yeah. And they blew up some of the images for the astronauts up to 40 by 45 feet in size. And then they had them walking around on the imagery, sort of pretending as they're coming into land, learning about the features of where they'd be landing and knowing how to navigate. You know, basically, you've got to stay right of that big thing and this boulder is over here and that crater is over there. And so they, you know, sort of rote learn the features of the moon so they knew where they were going. Anywho, fascinating stuff. Those are our picks.
Awesome.
Jeffrey, we really appreciate you coming on the show. This has been a fascinating chat. We've talked about all sorts of stuff vaguely related to your job, some related not to your job, but fascinating regardless. And we hope everybody got a kick out of this. Thanks again for coming on the show and really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, AC. We'll see you guys next week.
Take care.
Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show. We'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as an MP3 or WAV file and provide a link so we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is brought to you by Keith Ritchie. For more information on Keith's music, head to music.kritchie.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and Google Play Store by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up for our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.